I'll do a few more questions very quickly. Any tips for staying with, working with neutral Vedana? Positive and negative ones are more tangible to see and to work with. There are some Buddhist teachers who say there's no such thing as neutral Vedana, but there's always, you know, some kind of positive or negative, pleasant or unpleasant tinge to the Vedana. In a way, I think what's important isn't so much staying with neutral Vedana. It's more where the real riches are to be had are in working with those times where it feels like there's nothing interesting going on. It's more of a sort of emotional level of things where, you know, you just fall out because you're bored. Because those are all times where there's nothing for your ego project to get involved with. It's like, you know, listening to conversations or, you know, listening to me going on about the Dharma. You know, some of it you think, oh yes, that's really engaging. But then I go off and, you know, perhaps I'm a bit tired today and so my voice is a bit low. And you just feel, oh, there's nothing in this for me. And so then you just go dull or you go elsewhere. So catching those times is really interesting. Boredom is a real gateway to things because it's, those are the times where we're not doing the ego project very strongly. So what is going on? We can explore all that. But I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, really trying to pin down, you know, neutral Vedana. Please offer advice on integrating political and otherworldly, that's either news or views. Good question. Into our Dharma practice. Whichever it is. I guess very, very briefly. If it's views, then we have to bring that into relationship with the Dharma. How much of this political view is right for you? And as I said in answer to the question the other day, we have lots of people in the crowd who all hold different opinions and views that aren't in line with the Dharma, but who haven't ever actually had a conversation with the part of us that are engaged with the Dharma. So they need to be engaged. You need to bring all that in. And in general these days, it's more and more of a tendency in society for people to just stay within groupings where their views don't bump into unpleasant, you know, different views that other people out there hold. You know, we can kind of get all our, you know, our news about the world from, you know, media, which, you know, we agree with largely. The whole net is kind of set up so that, you know, we go from one thing that we like to something else that we like to something else that we like. So you end up with these whole kind of groupings who are not talking to one another at all. You know, you can see it in the states and the sort of political system, and kind of the Republicans and the Democrats. They're living in different worlds and kind of demonising one another, and there's very little meeting. It's becoming more and more fractured. Yeah. So it's, in a way, that's just what happens in us writ large. So we have to make sure that, yeah, when we notice that we're thinking in a particular way, we have to keep bringing that into how does that connect with the Dharma. And if it were political and otherworldly news, it's a whole big topic there. I'm not sure I could go into it, really. I want to write something about overwhelm sometimes, see. Overwhelm, you know. Just getting overwhelmed, you know, by the suffering, you know, the refugee crisis, the war in Syria, climate change, how one can engage with that without, just falling into horrified anxiety, really. Where, from which branch of Tibetan Buddhism does Tonglen come? Or who taught it? Who taught it initially? And does Bante teach it? And how does it fit into our system? All the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism, they all teach Tonglen. It's basic to all of them. It goes back to a teacher, you know, who came to Tibet in, scholars differ, 1040 something. And it goes back really to Shantideva and exchanging self and other in the Bodhicharyavatara. That's where it kind of comes from. But then it got taken to Tibet and it was spread through all of Tibetan Buddhism as part of a system of what's called Lojong, which means mind training. So we can say the lineage goes from Shantideva to Atisha and then down to us. And does Bante teach it? He certainly taught on the Bodhicharyavatara, and the Tonglen practice is included in our bodhicitta practice in our Mula Yogas. How does it fit in the system? You can say it's a development of positive emotion, obviously. It's a training in metta and a training in compassion and a training in empathy. It has an insight component because, again, you're working against that self-referential tendency, that belief in self, you're softening that self-other duality, and you usually do it either with the support of the refuges. So in the bodhicitta practice, you start by visualizing our refuge tree, or in some versions of the practice, it's as if you have the refuge there in some way, and really your sense is that the refuge is doing the practice. You're not doing it. The refuge is doing it. So there's a spiritual rebirth element there as well. So basically somebody decided to chant a mantra which isn't the mantra of the practice they do, and before they knew it, the figure was really there and they had a very strong experience. So what's the best thing to do when that happens? That is, I've not been given the sadhana. So the best thing to do when that happens is completely go along with it. Just really let it happen. Yeah. There you are, you know, trying to do the Vajrasattva practice and all the qualities of awakening, appear before you in the form of Padmasambhava, And you go, sir, we have not been introduced. And you refuse to talk to them. And go back to your somehow rather dull hydrosattva practice, which you weren't really into. So yes, please, you know, allow... Yes, we sometimes get very compartmentalised and fixed, you know, the sort of Vajrasattva over there and there's Tara over here, and even we start kind of getting into just everyday kind of feelings about them, you know, as if somehow, you know, if I was practising Padmasambhava and I golf with Tara, you know, Padmasambhava is going to be jealous or something. you know, they're not like kind of, you know, Greek gods and goddesses or something. They just aren't. Yeah. They're all manifestations of reality, all manifestations of the positive qualities of reality. So yes, whenever something like that appears, yeah, you know, just drop whatever you're doing and, you know, be completely at the service of the experience. And if it keeps, and yeah, then it's good if you can have some kind of continuity of practice, so yeah, you have something that you keep working with, and if something like that happens, the first thing you aim to do is see whether you can integrate that experience into your existing practice. But if it keeps happening, well, then it's happening for a reason, so you might need to address it by doing some of that other practice, but you're not doing something essentially different. Do you see what I mean? It's all much more fluid and dynamic than that. Not. Yes. That's clear. Is this a rather basic question? Oh well. I don't understand. This is the questioner, not me. I don't understand the difference between vertical and horizontal integration. Did the Buddha teach this? And if so, where and who to? Well, really, this is Bhante's terminology, and horizontal integration is really bringing into consciousness and bringing onto the path just different aspects of everyday experience and everyday us, let's call it that, yeah? Vertical integration involves deeper or higher, whichever way you want to talk about it, levels of experience. So, for instance, an experience of dhyana would be an experience of a more vertical integration. Or I'd probably say that an experience of... for instance, some deep symbol sort of coming into consciousness, that would be a vertical integration. So did the Buddha teach this? Well, I'm not sure what terminology vertical and horizontal integration would sort of translate back to in the Buddha's teaching, but he certainly taught that kind of mindfulness, and he certainly taught dhyana and so on. If everything is in a state of becoming, how is continuity of purpose or practice possible? How is memory sustained? So everything is in a state of becoming, fair enough. How is continuity of purpose or practice possible? How is memory sustained? This is often more a question when people get into... meditating on there just being the present moment. Yeah. It's like all you can find, you know, all you can find in direct experience is the present moment. And they sometimes, you know, which is a very helpful way to practice, and it's helpful in meditation to have a little kind of filter, you know, am I in the past, am I in the future, am I in the present, as a way of chopping down prapancha. And it's also very good on more of an insight level to just be aware of what you can actually find, and what you can find is this moment. And yet, there is clearly past and future do mean something. If there was literally just what we experience in the present moment, you wouldn't understand a word of what I'm saying, because all the previous words which would give sense to this sentence, they're gone, haven't they? They're not there. You wouldn't have them, so you wouldn't understand them, so life would become impossible. So, yeah, these things do mean something, and it's true. And the Buddha teaches that there's a, what we could loosely call a flow of experience, is becoming, everything arising, not that there are any things, nothing of the quiet comes into existence. There's becoming, just dependent arising, whole constant conditioning. So how is all this possible, and how do you practice with it? Partly I don't want to answer that, because one good question is worth 100 answers often. If you, you might be better off just exploring it for yourself. What I will say is that another way, I've been using the analogy of the crowd, which is a sort of spatial image. You know, we're trying to convert more and more of the crowd to the Dharma. But also talking in terms of momentum. So momentum is more that kind of flow image, isn't it? So it's a bit like, it's a bit like before the Olympics. You know, in the Olympic Stadium, somebody lights the Olympic torch. And that Olympic torch has been carried, I think, from Greece, where the first Olympics were in 1896. And there's a torch lit in Greece, and then they have these kind of relays of runners, you know, and it goes on for months and months leading up to the Olympics. And, you know, celebrities carry the torch, and sporting greats carry the torch, and local people win, you know, kind of competitions to carry the torch for a bit. So you get all kinds of people, yeah? But they all have to carry the torch and pass it on, which means there has to be a kind of continuity of purpose which goes through all of them, yeah? Otherwise, the thing kind of just goes out and it's kind of left, you know, in a ditch somewhere in Lancashire. So what we're aiming to do is build enough momentum, to get enough of ourselves, enough behind our Dharma practice, to be clear enough about our Dharma practice, you know, to be so heartfelt with it, and so clear about why it's the most wonderful thing that we could ever think to do, and that it's possible, and we can do it, that as we go through all the different situations in our life, that continuity of, there's a continuity of purpose through that motivation being passed on, like the torch, from one person to the next, through the different sort of selves, if you see, in this analogy. And some of them, you know, they really go for it, and, you know, they were, you know, they're Mo Farah or somebody, they, you know, they're great runners, and they kind of stroll along, and they, you know, they pass on the torch. But then they pass on the torch to someone from the local bakery who, you know, got sort of won the competition to run the next 400 yards with it. Still, somehow, through all those different bits, you know, the ones who are tired, the ones who aren't really into it, and the ones who are really behind it, the torch has to just get passed. It has to be passed and passed and passed and passed until finally, yeah, you know, it lights this great fire for, you know, thousands, millions of people watching all around the world. Get the okay. There are a couple of questions I didn't get to, but I know who you are, so we'll find ways of answering those for you. Let's finish just with a few minutes. So we've done some basic integration practice, just being with the breathing. We've worked with the breath and positive emotion and getting in touch with the emotions and tonglen. We've done stuff with the breath and spiritual death. As we've breathed out, not knowing whether we'd breathe in again. We just let go completely into space. We breathed in, completely opening to life. Breathed out, letting go completely. This evening we'll do a little something with the breath and spiritual rebirth. So now let's just breathe. Becoming receptive to all our experience in the moment. So we're using the breathing as an anchor, maybe below the navel, or just keeping a background awareness of the breath. Help us stay fully present. We're aware of the body. Aware of its weight, its posture. Aware of the feelings and sensations of Vedanas. Aware of any sounds we can hear. Not judging or labeling. Staying close to the simple experience. Aware of anything in our visual field, if our eyes are open, and any patterns on the backs of the eyelids if they're closed. Aware of anything we can smell, any tastes in our mouth. We're aware of feelings and emotions, images, words. Everything that's happening in the mental consciousness. And just open to it all. With the breath as an anchor. So that we don't get lost. We don't need to choose what to concentrate on or focus on. There's just a field of kindly awareness within which these moments of our life are unfolding.